Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
What I want to talk about today are two different things. Number one are some interesting materials that exist within cells. And number two is technologies that we're working on to develop entities that behave like cells. That is the question of how can we rebuild these structures. The picture that I'm showing here is one of the motivations for our work, and it's a fish keratocyte cell. So this is a cell that's involved in wound healing. If there weren't cell motility in wound healing, we wouldn't do a very good job of patching over wounds. The ability of cells to move, to crawl, to change shape is critical for a wide variety of health maintenance tasks, wound healing as well as surveillance by the immune system. And the structures that are within cells, the materials within cells, are the focus of the first part of the talk. So we start with some relatively simple sets of questions. Number one is, how are cells organized for movement? You can get a little sense of that from this fluorescence image. So just to tell you what's labeled here, the front or the top of the cell is labeled red, and those are the actin filaments that form a leading edge that drives the displacement of the cell membrane. What's labeled in green are adhesion sites. So you see a gradation of adhesion sites from the front of the cell at the top towards the back. And then what's being lugged around kind of as dead weight is the nucleus. Now, of course, the nucleus was important at one time, but as I'll try and show you, what the cell can do in the way of movement doesn't have anything to do with the nucleus. So that was question number one. How are cells organized, and what are the material properties of the structures that are important for this cell movement? And then second, can I build one? Is there a way to take the parts that we're understanding are important for cell movements and actually put them together in functional structures that have some of the capabilities of cells? So those would be the topics that I'll discuss today. So first of all, some movies. So cell movements have fascinated me for a long time, and this was the movement that kind of sucked me in from engineering over to more biology. The fact that we could engineer remarkably complex instruments, and yet simply looking at a crawling cell 10, 20 microns in diameter, move across the surface, is far more complex than anything we've developed. And so the mysteries of exactly how those structures work, how those material properties are defined, has driven our interest, and I think has great potential for developing new materials for treatment of diseases. So this is a fish keratocyte, and it's sped up, and this is crawling across a glass slide. So very simple movement. You see this characteristic crescent shape. And what happens is this cell is trying to figure out how to patch the wound that caused it to be released. So the way you generate these cells are you take a goldfish and you pluck a scale off of it and you culture it in media, and then you wait overnight and off will crawl these sheets of fish keratocyte cells. Now, of course, you need to do that with the proper approvals, but once you have those proper approvals, watching these cells is enormous fun. And an enormous mystery as well. So I'll give you an example of one mystery. So this is another fish keratocyte cell, but what's placed here in its way is a little step. So this is just a little half micron step that the cell can or may not go over. So I want you to mentally decide what you think is going to happen. The cell is going to crawl towards this, and there are a few possibilities. It could run into this barrier and decide, I can't do it. That's too complicated an environment for me. I'm going to stop. It could just hop right over that, could ignore that step entirely, or it could hit the surface and bounce off. So a number of different possibilities, including others. So we tried this just to see what would happen. So with your guess in mind, we'll see if you're right. Okay, so it runs into it. It changes orientation and essentially bounces off. And this is a process that took place over about 5 minutes. So we've sped this movie up so you can see what happens, but it interacts with it. You can see changes in the lamellipodium on the far side of the cell, not interacting with the surface, and it changes movement. So this is to emphasize that cells have to undergo quite dramatic and adaptive behaviors during the normal course of their life. This is not something that's going to be transiently regulated by the nucleus. This is something that the entire cell, the cytoplasm, and the underlying cytoskeleton have to be able to accommodate. And to emphasize that it's really the cytoplasm and the cytoskeleton that has this adaptive, intelligent capability, here's an example of a fish keratocyte that has lost its nucleus. And the way you can do this is take a glass pipette, slice off the back end of the fish keratocyte, or treat it with a drug that will reduce the tension in the membrane, and it will simply crawl away from the nucleus. And so this is just a fragment. What you see here are some organelles that remain, but this is primarily the front edge of that cell. And if we press go, you can see that this fragment of a cell also has the capability to move. And this gives us hope that there are a set of proteins organized in a specific way that can sustain movement. Now, we all expected that at some level, but to see it reduced to a bag of components organized in a specific way gives us hope that one day we may be able to reconstruct capabilities like this. So let me go to the heart of the matter, and that is, what are the materials inside this structure that are allowing it to generate a force, allowing it to carry out the processive steps of motility, which include protrusion, adhesion, release of adhesion, and contraction? Well, a lot of the clues for how the first step works, the protrusion step, came from a bacterium. This is a bacterium known as Listeria monocytogenes, and if you've ever had really, really severe food poisoning, this may have been the cause of it. In France, a little bit of Listeria monocytogenes is tolerated because it's found on cheeses, and if you were to pasteurize your cheese, you can get rid of it, but not all places would like to get rid of fresh cheese. So this is more prevalent in France than in this country, although in this country, the largest recall in history of turkey was a result of Listeria monocytogenes contamination. And the way that this bacterium works, and the reason why it's such a risk to health, is that it harnesses the host cell cytoskeleton to move from cell to cell. The best way to avoid the immune system is to be inside of a host cell, because once you're inside of a host cell, the immune system doesn't recognize you're there. And what Listeria can do is take advantage of the cytoskeleton that's involved in protrusive movements of the leading edge and allows the cell to protrude from cell to cell unbeknownst to the immune system. So how does it do this? This is the process we've been studying, and this is the material I want to tell you about. The dendritic nucleation at the leading edge. So the cytoskeleton involves three primary sets of polymers, actin filaments, microtubules, and intermediate filaments. And I want to focus on one of those, one of the more highly dynamic components. So these long polymers here are the actin filaments, and they undergo a process of branching. You go from a single straight filament to a branch if you bind and activate a branching protein, this little green blob here. Now, those branching proteins only can be activated if they're close to a surface. In the case of Listeria, there's a protein on the Listeria surface that activates that protein and causes actin filaments to branch. Similarly, motile cells, there's an active protein on the surface that causes the branching to take place. So filaments are elongating, and they turn over over time. They grow, they get longer, and if they get near to the surface, they can branch. Those that don't get near to the surface are eventually capped and removed from the process. So this recycled steps of growth, branching, and capping lead to the formation of a dendritic network. And the interesting thing is those proteins can all be purified and reconstituted in vitro. So here's an example from a colleague at UCSF showing a bead that's emulating this bacterium coated with a particular factor that nucleates branches. And you can see this tail, which is fluorescently labeled actin, growing from the back end of the bead. And if the bead were not attached to the surface, this would generate a force. So this is a simple growth process, a simple material that's able to generate a force and the same sort of forces that are involved in protrusion of these crawling cells. So we became interested in the properties of these materials. What is it that allows the cell to both grow and resist deformations. So as you saw when the cell ran into that barrier, it had to undergo a process of reorganization. So first of all, what are the mechanical properties of these networks? And second, how do they respond to loads? And the way we tried to answer that question was with atomic force microscopy. Now, Santa Barbara is the home of AFM, essentially. Two of the leading companies in this field operate out of Santa Barbara. So I'm sure this audience doesn't need any introduction to atomic force microscopy. But for those who haven't heard much, this is a surface imaging tool, primarily. It's a tool that's used to look at topography and a number of other properties. And the property that we were most interested in was stiffness. Now, you can measure stiffness of reconstituted protein systems if you're able to localize them in the right place. So rather than trying to take a topographical image, as one would normally do with an AFM, we decided to park it in one place, put the nucleating protein that's like on the back end of that bacterium or on the leading edge of a crawling cell. We put that protein right at the very end of the cantilever, and we immerse it in an extract of cells, so it has all the components it needs to be able to assemble that network, and then we let it grow. And if it grows and hits the lower surface, it begins to generate a force that deflects the cantilever. So in this way, we can set up a structure that's very much like that protrusion in a crawling cell. We can apply a load to it, and we can begin to measure mechanical properties and growth rates. So we've done that. Here's a little video of what it looks like. So what you're looking at is a fluorescent image from the side. Here's the cantilever. There's the little tip. The glass surface is here, and so you see a reflection of the cantilever. And then this this bright stuff here, that's the actin network that's growing against the cantilever. So it's growing between the cantilever and the glass surface, and this is what can generate a force. Now, in many force measurement tools, you can enter different modes of operation, and in this particular mode of operation, we have what's called a force clamp, meaning that the network is not allowed to generate anything beyond a certain force, and when it does reach that force, we lower the surface so that the force doesn't increase. And so in that way, we can get a velocity for a given force. So here's what the growth looks like, and that's sped up. You can see all that's happening here is that the proteins are assembling. They're assembling at this surface right here, which mimics the leading edge, and they're pushing against the cantilever and the surface. So this is the way that we reform this network, this material that's inside of the leading edge of cells. So the next question was mechanical properties. There had been quite a bit of work done on entangled actin filament networks because they provide a good model system for studying semi-flexible polymers. So from a physics community perspective, it was an interesting set of polymers. But entangled actin filaments are not what we find at the leading edge of cells. They're highly organized structures, these branched dendritic arbors that are generating the force. So how might the mechanical properties of these highly branched structures under a compressive load, how might they behave? So we did a simple rheology experiment where the network grew to a certain length, and then we applied a small oscillation as we changed the load on it. So it's just as if we're squishing the cushion on a couch. We're squishing it and then oscillating, squishing it, oscillating, and trying to figure out what the resistance is at those different levels of applied stress. So if we increase our stress here, we can measure an elastic modulus, a local elastic modulus for that material. And what we see as we increase the stress was that initially there's some regime of linear elasticity where the elastic modulus doesn't change. And then all of a sudden we see stiffening. So as we push harder, it becomes harder and harder still to increase the deflection of that material. But at some point, we reach a peak and the material softens. And so typically, you would see something like this in, say, a rheometer experiment when your material has failed. When something has broken, that's usually why the elastic modulus goes down. Surprisingly, though, we found that when we reduced the stress on this network, the elastic modulus recovered. So as we went backwards, reducing the stress, measuring elastic properties, reducing stress, and again measuring elastic properties, we found that this nearly replicated the elasticity curve in compression. So this is a material that has both strain stiffening behavior and strain softening behavior. Well, why is that? Well, we did many measurements of this to convince ourselves it was correct. And we see these three regimes over and over: linear elasticity, nonlinear elasticity, stress stiffening, and then stress softening behavior. So what could potentially explain that? And this is a material, again, that the cell has to use as its front edge. And you can imagine if you're a crawling cell pushing against an external environment, whether it's extracellular matrix, cell-cell junctions, you need to be able to generate a force to push through these structures. As you encounter resistance, that network also stiffens. And at some point, though, if this is a structure that's simply not going to be displaced through, the network is able to reduce its elasticity. So it's something like a crash zone built into the front of these cells. So what physically might explain the properties of this dendritic actin network material? What we think is happening is a combination of the mechanical properties of entropic filaments and the mechanical properties of enthalpic filaments, meaning that there are two different kinds or sources of elasticity which are at work in these networks. At the early stages, we see simply stretching of filaments that leads to a stress stiffening type behavior, like has been seen in many kinds of entangled actin filament networks and cross-link actin filament networks. At some point, though, because we're under compressive load and the filaments are primarily oriented towards that surface that's being compressed, we begin to see filament buckling. This is our hypothesis, that filament buckling is responsible for the reduction in elastic properties. As the long filaments buckle, the stress is distributed to fewer filaments, and as the long ones of those remaining filaments buckle, on and on and on, the resistance to further displacement is decreased, which is equivalent to a lower modulus. So we think we're seeing a case in which both the entropic properties and the enthalpic properties of these filaments are relevant. So it really is a semi-flexible polymer in which both of those properties matter. Those are the static properties. What about dynamic properties? The dynamic properties end up being even more complex. So this is a network that is growing and generating force to propel the cell forward and move the cell membrane. So when it encounters a force, so we went through a series of experiments where we changed the force on this growing network. If we start at a low force here, we have a certain amount of velocity. If we turn off the force clamp, which means that now the network is allowed to generate more force as it grows, we see that the force against the cantilever is increasing, but the velocity doesn't actually change that much. But if we then reduce the force back to its original load, we find that the velocity is now much higher. So this is an example of a material which is irreversible, at least over the timescales of these measurements. Unlike molecular motors and other force-generating systems in cells, where if you increase the load, the motor will slow down. You decrease the load, the motor will speed up. You increase, slows down, decrease, speeds up. It's reversible. In a network which involves multiple molecules, multiple branching, what we seem to be seeing is an irreversible behavior that we think is due to increase in density of filaments. And that increase in density of filaments then leads to lower force over more filaments, and therefore a higher velocity, which is sustained. So this this understanding of the network behavior is helping us to get a better and more complete picture of how it is that cells, when they crawl through tissue, are able to adapt to the different environments they find themselves in. Okay, so I'll return to this image of a keratocyte fragment moving on a surface. Because at some level, we would want to be able to test the ideas about how these systems work, but in a system in which we can fully control all of the properties. And if we can fully control all the properties, that means the membrane properties as well as the composition inside of the vesicle. And this is related to the challenges in liposomal drug delivery. From a very different perspective, in drug delivery, you want to be able to get a certain content, a certain drug, to a specific location in the right amount at the right time. Very complicated challenge. The developments in drug delivery have been advancing over the years, and instead of simply delivering drugs systemically, they're now encapsulated in small liposomes, and those liposomes can then be functionalized, coated with pegylation, and in research stages, also attached with antibodies that help with localization. But in the end, we want to be able to get to a kind of drug delivery that emulates the way that the body attacks invasion. So if you have a puncture wound and you get bacteria into your tissue, your neutrophils and macrophages are alerted to that fact and actually migrate to the site of the disease. Rather than having drugs that distribute everywhere, it would be ideal if we could harness the capability of our white blood cells to locate where they need to go and imbue liposomes with the ability to move. So someday we hope to be able to do something like that. But in order to do that, we have to have the fabrication tools that let us create these structures. And so I want to talk to you about steps we've been taking to create structures that resemble cells. So we have an interest in reconstituting cellular systems using the purified proteins like I discussed for the actin network system. Can we show that, for example, a vesicle is able to generate a protrusion? That's of great interest using the proteins that we know are regulating cell motility. Look at some of the possibilities. If you want to look at biochemical systems in confined settings, you can think about a few different strategies for doing it. Single emulsions, double emulsions, or vesicles, and each have a different kind of interface. So an aqueous solution in oil, if lipids are present in that oil, you can form a monolayer. If you have a double emulsion, you can form two monolayers, but they're separated by this oil layer. Or more close to what cells, how cells are organized, is a bilayer in which you can insert membrane proteins or have transport through pores. So this is a structure that we would like to be able to build to start to assemble the motility machinery. So how can we do that? So we've developed a technique that is essentially the same as blowing a bubble. So if you've ever taken, dipped in soap and blown a bubble, then you understand how this technique works. It takes just the right amount of force, just the right amount of volume in order to form a deformation which will pinch off and contain whatever was in your breath. So we essentially do the same thing. We have two aqueous droplets that are placed in oil. Each forms a monolayer. This is a technique, the two-droplet technique originally developed by Hagen Bailey to study pore proteins. And if you bring those two droplets together, you form a bilayer that excludes the oil. And if you exclude the oil, you now have a nice suspended planar lipid bilayer. We then bring a piezoelectrically driven microjet against this interface. And if we control the voltage just right and the volume of fluid just right, we can essentially blow a bubble. And if we blow a bubble, we've contained in that bubble what came out of the jet. And by that process, we can start to build up more complex structures. So I'll show you some movies of how this works. So what we're doing here is simply shooting a sucrose solution into glucose so you get some contrast, you can see. And what forms here is this tip vortex. So if you like fluid dynamics, this is a beautiful little tip vortex which is generated by this small jet. If we now move this jet against a planar bilayer, and it's a little obscured because we're looking down through a curved surface, but somewhere in the middle here is a planar bilayer, and if we shoot at that planar bilayer, you can see that there's a deformation of the bilayer, this was not hard enough or large enough volume to cause a pinch-off of the vesicles. So if we then control the velocity and the volume more precisely, we can form a vesicle. So this is a vesicle that's formed in a few milliseconds, and it contains a mixture of the contents that were in the jet and the contents that were around the jet. And so this process of encapsulation allows us to control the content and begin to study the organization. I'll give you, to conclude, I'll give you a few examples of how we've been using this technique to start to build organized structures within vesicles. So here's the jet. In this case, we're trying to form a rudimentary actin cytoskeleton within the vesicle. We load in monomeric protein. We put around the outside a buffer that promotes polymerization. And so when we fire those two in, we get mixing of the polymerization buffer with the subunits, and that generates a mixture of entangled filaments, and we can show that those are entangled looking at diffusible objects. So that's an example of formation of cytoskeletal structures, and we've more recently been looking at whether we can get protein expression into vesicles like this. Rather than purifying proteins and having to put them all inside, why not simply express the proteins that we want? So that would be difficult in the case of actin, but for other proteins, that's a possibility. Here's an example of loading in an expression system plus plasmids and getting GFP expression. And of course, the theme of this meeting has been high throughput. So we've aimed to do high throughput. Here's an example at 200 hertz of forming vesicles. We can form them continuously at low speeds as well. So I think that's where I want to end. The possibility to start to reconstruct systems is exciting because it gives us the chance to try and harness some of the unique properties of biological systems and put them to work for ourselves. So with that, I'll end with the motivations for cellular reconstitutions, and I'll thank my group as well as very helpful interactions with our NIH Center, the Cell Propulsion Lab. Thanks very much.
In your movies, where the cells were moving and they bounced against an obstacle, the lamellipodia on the back end seem to have extended, and maybe they're probing something on the barrier. Can you comment on that?
So when the cell was interacting,
right?
The point of interaction seems to be sticking.
The lamellipodia were small when the cell was free floating, but when it came in contact with the barrier, the lamellipodia seem to have gotten much longer and more dendritic.
It seems that it suppresses the polymerization on the side that's adjacent to the barrier and seems to enhance it in the side that's distal, which makes it appear that it's expanding. And we think that has something to do with the coupling through the membrane, that the membrane tension seems to be a great regulator of cell motility, and the tension is disrupted when you have this barrier that it relaxes against.
Or are you able to control the volume or the size?
So for a given set of vesicles, they're monodispersed within a few percent in terms of diameter. We can control the diameters somewhere between 10 and 300 microns. If one wants to go smaller, clearly liposomes are going to be smaller than that, then extrusion is the way to get smaller structures still.
Before I sort of begin going into the materials aspects of things, I thought I'll take you through what is done currently in the field so you get an idea of what goes on and what the problems are. I'll talk to you some about some molecular approaches that people are trying out. I'll give you my ideas of what I think a useful neural interface would look like, and then I will conclude my talk. The first question you have to ask yourself is, why are neural interfaces even important? So they are the fundamental building block to building devices that can be used to restore lost function. The most famous of this is the FDA-approved cochlear implant. For those of you who follow politics, you must have noticed that Rush Limbaugh has one of these things. This company actually made $130 million in profit last year. So recently there was an ex-Marine that was fitted with a haptic bionic arm with which he was able to reach and grab hold of things. I'll talk to you about the retinal prosthesis, which is very similar to the cochlear prosthesis, and it's used to restore vision. And recently there is a lot of interest in using electrical stimulation for Parkinson's disease. Medtronic has actually put a lot of money into this. So I don't know how many of you are biologists, of course, most of you are, so I'm going to sort of skip this. But the idea behind it is to sort of give you some sort of background behind what actually makes neurons function. You have a lot of sodium outside, a lot of potassium inside, and when you actually go through the neurotransmitter binding event, the sodium channel will open, sodium comes in, and eventually closes, and then potassium will go out, and that will be related to the action potential. So this happens over and over again. And our goal in building synthetic neural interfaces is to sort of interface with the nerve. And in order to interface with the nerve, you've got to sort of understand how you can model it, and the best model out there is the Hodgkin-Huxley model, where you can model a piece of the cell membrane with electrical components. You have the cell membrane capacitance, you have its conductances, and you have the resting membrane potential, which comes from the drift diffusion balance, which is given by the Nernst equation. So in electrical stimulation, what we would like to do is to increase the membrane potential. So you want to basically make this membrane potential grow larger. And the way you do that is you apply some sort of stimulus. We'll talk about what this stimulus is. And eventually, when the stimulus reaches a certain threshold, the nerve will fire. So this is sort of the idea behind what we want to do. So if somebody were to come to me, for example, and say, well, I want to control the membrane potential of the cell, I would say, well, why don't you just put a battery across the cell? That would be easy. But the unfortunate aspect is you cannot really access the interior of the cell electrically. So even though you can represent these as conductances in electrical jargon, these are not really electron accessible. They are only ionically accessible. So the only handle you have from the outside world is through this membrane capacitance. So this is what people do normally. So you place a pair of electrodes. One is the stimulating electrode and one is the return electrode. And you pass some current through it. And some of that current will actually go through this membrane capacitance and it will charge the membrane up. And that is actually what causes the cell to fire. So what is the goal of a retinal prosthesis? The goal of a retinal prosthesis is to basically restore some level of useful vision to people who have become blind due to diseases like age-related macular degeneration and retinitis pigmentosa. And in both these diseases, what happens is there is a loss of photoreceptors. So let's take a step back. So normally, light enters, goes all the way through, hits the rods and cones, and then information propagates back down through the horizontal bipolar amacrine and then the ganglion cells, which eventually form your optic nerve. So in this disease, the photoreceptor gets lost, and therefore there is no conversion of light to neurotransmitter. So your first step in the cascade is broken, so the person becomes blind. So how will a retinal implant work? Well, we want to be able to electrically stimulate the remaining healthy layers that are present in the retina using brief biphasic current pulses. So just like we talked about a few slides ago, if you were to put some current into a stimulating and electrode pair, it will get the nerve to fire. So this in turn will produce what are called phosphenes. Now, if you've ever hit your head really, really hard, it's called seeing stars. You see these flashes of light. That's exactly what a phosphene is. And vision is nothing but a series of phosphenes put together. And we are hoping that the patient will put this sort of phosphenes together to form a useful image. So the next question you've got to ask yourself is, where would you put a retinal prosthesis, or where would you put a visual prosthesis in general? So one idea is to put it in the cortex. The nice thing about putting it in the cortex is if your optic nerve or anything is damaged, you can still restore vision by directly interfacing with the visual cortex. The bad thing about it is that you cannot actually take advantage of the retinal machinery that is present in your eye. The other option is to put it on the optic nerve, and this has actually been done in Belgium, and this device is being implanted in, I think, 3 patients, and they can make out rough outlines of shapes, And here, what they do is they actually put a cuff electrode around your optic nerve and stimulate your optic nerve. And the problem with this, of course, is the fact that the optic nerve is a bundled fiber, and it's very hard to get specificity of where you're trying to stimulate. The other option is what is called a epiretinal implant, which means you're putting it in the front of the eye on the retina itself. And here you have an external camera, and you have some sort of stimulating chip that gets in the data and then stimulates your eye. So there are actually two companies that are based on this concept. One is here in California. It's called Second Sight. And the other one is out in Germany. It's called Intelligent Medical Implants. And it basically works on the same principles. They're both based off of the same idea. The other option you have is to place the device in what is called the subretinal space, or behind the retina. So if you put the device there, it's called a subretinal implant. And there are two companies that follow this. One is a active implant, which is followed by the Germans, and their company, for lack of imagination, is called Retina Implant. And there is a company in Chicago which generated a lot of news about 5 years ago, I think. It's called Optobionics. Here what they did was they just took a regular solar cell and put it behind the eye, and they claimed that it was restoring vision, but later it turned out that it was just a neuroprotective effect. So when I was a graduate student at MIT, we have a collaboration with Harvard Medical School and the Mass Eye and Ear, and we actually have done our own acute human testing. So the results were very encouraging. So what they did here was you make a small incision in the eye, you place a polyimide electrode array in the eye, you weight it down with a gold weight, and that's how the array looks on the fundus photograph of the eye. And it's made of polyimide, and this electrode is made of iridium oxide. And when you ask the patient what they saw by stimulating or basically passing current through four electrodes, the patient is able to draw four spots. So it seems like the idea behind restoring vision with some sort of intervention therapy is possible. So the idea behind it is you get some image, you wirelessly transmit the image into the eye, you stimulate the eye, and eventually the person has a perception of the image. So in order to circumvent a lot of the issues that we had with the implant in general, because one of the biggest problems with the eye is it's very, very small, so you want to make sure that you don't put a lot of your bulky components inside the eye. So what we decided to do was only place the electrode array behind the eye in the subretinal space and keep all the electronics outside the eye. So this is called a minimally invasive subretinal approach. And here is the actual implant that was designed. And so let's take a closer look at this. So it consists of a pair of coils. So you have a power and data coil, which actually wirelessly get the power and the data from the outside, so you don't have any batteries that are implanted. And it basically sends the data over to a integrated circuit, which receives the information. And this is then sent to a stimulating array, which is made of polyimide and iridium oxide, and then you stimulate the retina. So I spent a good part of my PhD, because I had a background in VLSI design, designing this stimulator chip so that this implant could actually function. And here are the experimental results from an animal trial. So this is a eye of a Yucatan mini pig with the implant actually implant in it. And you can see that this is the, so here what the experiment is that you place an electrode in the cortex and you record the stimulus artifact by pulsing current into the eye. And you can see the control has no response, whereas right after, immediately post-op, you get the device functioning properly, and it keeps functioning even 12 weeks after the implant has been inside the animal, even though there is a lot of glial formation. So the question you have to ask yourself is, what is the problem? Because here you are, you've designed an implant, it's able to function in an animal, and if you've read the New York Times, I think it was 2 weeks ago, There was an article about a woman who actually climbed the Eiffel Tower using one of these devices. So, but there is still not a widespread prevalence of these devices. So what is the key problem here? One of the biggest problems is that if you want somebody to say they saw something, so this is actually from human data, so we actually even had a normally sighted patient because there was this person who had ocular cancer and she was going to get her eye removed and she volunteered to give us some data. And you can see that the current required to stimulate is pretty high. It's 1.6 milliamperes. So if you put this in perspective, from a 5-volt supply, this is about 7.5 milliwatts. So your eye or tissue can tolerate about 10 milliwatts before it starts to degrade due to heat. So here you have one electrode, which is dissipating 8 milliwatts. Okay, let's take a little bit of a different step and say charge is the most important thing, so we can obviously increase the duration and stimulate at a lower current. So you get a factor of about 8 difference from here. So you've gone from about one electrode to about, say, 10 electrodes. Oh, this is all well and good. The only problem with this approach is your eye has 140 million photoreceptors. If you're hoping to restore vision with 10 electrodes, you're barking up the wrong tree. So you've got to sort of think of the problem in a different, because the scale of the problem is very different. So what's the problem? The biggest problem is that if you put an electrode in an electrolyte, most of the current is actually going to go through the electrolyte because the electrolyte is conductive. So you are actually wasting most of the energy by bypassing the nerve and not really stimulating the nerve. So that is a big problem with electrical stimulation. The other problem, materials problem that you have is this is the state-of-the-art electrode which is made of iridium oxide. You start pulsing it with current inside a saline solution, you can see that after current, it completely degrades over time. So this is a huge toxicity issue when it comes to implant materials. So what are the other approaches? What else could you do to mitigate this problem? So some researchers decided that, well, why don't we take a cue from biology itself? And what they did here was they took an algal protein, which is responsive to light. It's a proton pump, which is light triggered, which is also sensitive to sodium, and they had it expressed in the retina of a mouse. The only problem with this sort of expression is that it has no targeting put into the system, so not only does it express in the retina, it expresses all the way to the brain. So you end up having a fully light-sensitive system that doesn't really have the effect you wanted to have. So the other way to go about it is to actually molecularly gate the channel itself, and here you take an azobenzene molecule and you basically gate the potassium channel, and by using UV light, you can turn it on and off. The problem there is that you're using UV light, and that in itself is phototoxic, and so you have to be careful about how you actually implement this approach. So obviously, the first question you should ask yourself is, why not just use neurotransmitters? I mean, the body uses neurotransmitters. Why can't we use neurotransmitters to interface with the nervous system? The biggest problem with neurotransmitters is that you need to replenish your neurotransmitter from somewhere. So the simplest approach is to store the neurotransmitter, and the problem with that is that if there is any breakage of your storage pouch, you're going to destroy your tissue. And the other way to do it is to cage your neurotransmitter with a UV cage, and the problem with that, again, is that it requires a UV laser. So the question then is there a better way? So the fundamental problem really is that you cannot communicate with the inside of the cell using electrons. But you can communicate with it with the right ions. So the question then becomes, what ion would you choose? How would you actually go about this? So if you look at the fundamental equation that governs the balance between the inside and the outside, you see it's a ratio of different ions. But if you check the permeability at rest, the cell is most permeable to potassium. So you can pretty much ignore these two terms, and you're only left with the ratio of the potassium outside to the potassium inside. So the nice thing about an approach like this is potassium is freely available in your body, and all you need to figure out is how to actually gather it up and use it efficiently. So the idea then would be that if you were to release potassium salt outside, then you would be able to trigger the membrane potential into a positive feedback loop, which would make the cell fire. So I did a bunch of experiments on rabbit retina where you actually pulse a small dose of potassium onto the rabbit retina and you can actually record its response. So here you see a dose of potassium and its response to it. So the nice thing about it is that the threshold for activation is only a factor of about 2 above the background concentration. So it doesn't take very much energy to actually trigger the cell to make it fire. The other nice thing is that if you compare the light stimulation to the potassium stimulation, the width of the receptive field is approximately the same. And the reason for that is because it's a diffusive phenomena. So the concentration is a normalized thing, and as it starts to diffuse, it becomes less effective. So if you put it all together and you wanted to build yourself some sort of a synthetic implant, this is sort of what I had come up with. I'm sure there are different ways to do it. And I'm going to concentrate today on how you would actually build a polymeric material that you can actually use to sequester the ion from the background of the body itself. So the first thing you do is you sort of look to biology to get some inspiration. So you want to do some sort of ion capture and ion release. So yeah, you've heard a lot about micelles and vesicles and membranes and things like that. So the first thing, if you want to work in biological realm, is to actually come to the diffusion-limited domain, which is how you make yourself a very thin membrane. So you use solvent-driven self-assembly to do it, and most of you are familiar with the cell membrane, which has the lipid as its fundamental component, and the only problem with this is that you cannot actually use it because you can't take it out of the aqueous environment. So the better option is to actually use a polymeric membrane, which actually can also have the same property of self-assembly. And the construct here is a polyoxazoline with a hydrophobic siloxane in the middle with another hydrophilic polyoxazoline at the outside. And oxazolines are actually pretty good at being biocompatible, and they're now starting to rival polyethylene glycol in their properties. So the other big problem is that if you had some sort of ion chelating molecule, you can't just put it inside your cell membrane and just let it sit there, because given enough time, it'll partition out of the membrane because there's a finite partition coefficient. So the solution to this problem is to basically fix it with a very long arm so that the ion can actually hop from one carrier to the other carrier, because these are like hanging like pendulums and they actually sort of meet each other, and then the ion can hop from one point to the other point. So you can actually see that the mechanism would be a hopping mechanism rather than a simple diffusive mechanism. So we first synthesize the copolymer, which has the hydrophobic part, and then you synthesize the receptor, you attach your receptor, and then you want to sort of graft your polymer at the edges to make your self-assembling molecule. The only problem is you can't really do any sort of grafting, because if you try to do that, it'll actually cap the ends of the polymer that you're trying to design, and you can't get anywhere. So the better way to do it is actually to make a polymer that's capable of doing what is called macroinitiation and grow the polymer out. And you can actually grow it one strand by one strand. So you can actually make siloxanes which have very specific initiating groups by doing N-blocker synthesis, and you can tailor the molecular weight of your siloxanes by using this N-blocker. And then you can attach your carrier by using a platinum-catalyzed reaction, and then you can use that to basically polymerize your oxazoline. So the next question you have to ask yourself is what actually decides the type of aggregate, whether you're going to get micelles or where you're going to get vesicles, or you're going to get cylindrical micelles. And in lipids, it's determined by the volume-to-area ratio, but in polymers, it's actually determined by the hydrophilic to hydrophobic fraction. So if you actually have a hydrophilic fraction greater than the hydrophobic fraction, you'll end up with micelles, and if you have a hydrophobic fraction greater than the hydrophilic, you'll end up with a vesicle. So this is sort of the structure we are after. And you can see that this very same construct can be used for drug delivery and other purposes. So the bending energy is actually what causes vesicles to form. You have the classical Hookean term with the Gaussian curvature term. And the Gaussian curvature term is there to make sure that you don't end up with any saddle deformation with zero energy penalty. So we just heard from Daniel Fletcher about forming vesicles, these little membrane bubbles. He actually used a way of blowing through a planar lipid bilayer membrane and just creating vesicles. What I do is actually make, and the nice thing about that method is you can have a system which is different inside the vesicle and a solution that's different outside. Here we do what is called electroformation. Here you just take a thin polymer film, put it on an ITO glass, and subject it to an AC field. And the field will actually find defects in the film and make these bubbles as well. And the disadvantage of this method compared to the other method is that it has the same solution inside and outside. However, this is a very simple and easy method to creating vesicles. So when you go ahead and do this, you can see that the constructs that we made do actually self-assemble into ultra-thin compartmentalized particles. The other question then you have to ask yourself is, does it actually behave the way you want it to behave? So what happens when it's subjected to some sort of ion concentration outside? So if you actually add potassium to a suspension of these vesicles, they actually change shape from being spherical vesicles to becoming tubular vesicles. And the reason for that is it's a basically you're minimizing the energy between the electrostatic force and the bending energy of the polymer. If you subject it to sodium, you end up forming rigid rods. And if you have magnesium, it doesn't do anything because the receptor is not does not recognize the fact that this divalent cation is present. So you can see how you can use the same sort of system to actually release drugs on command or change shape, and you can make different kinds of systems with the same sort of motif. So you can actually get a little bit of understanding of what's actually going on by doing an NMR study. And here you can see that as soon as you subject it to a potassium stimulus, the side chain packing density changes, which is actually why it leads to this shape transformation. And the reason why it responds to both sodium and potassium is because the molecule forms a flat complex with potassium, but a sort of a crown complex with sodium. Not only do they have self-assembling properties at the macro scale, like in the micron scale, but they also have the same self-assembling properties even at the nanometer scale, and this you can study with TEM. So the next question you have to ask yourself is, okay, now you're able to sort of say you can stimulate from nerves. What about recording from neurons? So one of the big things about recording from neurons is that you want to be able to create what is called penetrating electrode arrays, so you can actually get to the nerve to be able to record from it. And the material of choice that people have sort of used is what is called SU8, which was done by IBM. And it's basically a photoperturbable epoxy resin. And it's commercially available. You can actually get 100-to-1 aspect ratios using photolithography techniques. The only problem with these posts are that they're very, very high stress materials, because when you do the epoxy polymerization, it develops a lot of stress in the film. And if you actually do a study of the bending stress, so this is classical silicon, and if you make a beam out of silicon and try to basically push on it, it'll deform at the base at about 108 micrometers from the point of initial standing. Whereas epoxy will break at 61 microns. Even though it's a polymeric material, it actually breaks much earlier. So a much more flexible material like siloxane, for example, can bend a lot further. So if you were to give a doctor something like a bunch of electrode arrays and you ask him to implant this, you would end up with a lot of broken electrodes. So you have to sort of come up with new materials to actually design penetrating electrodes. So one of the ideas is to basically use cellulose whiskers or something that actually can hydrogen bond inside, so it goes in very stiff, you implant it, it takes the water in and then breaks the hydrogen bonding and then becomes soft over time. So this was inspired by the sea cucumber, actually. And what we hope to do in the future is actually try to see if we can actually confer light-sensitive properties through the cell itself by intercalcating the cell membrane with light receptive polymeric materials. So I will stop right here. And if you have any questions, feel free to ask them.
Very nice work. I have a question about the shape change that you show.
Yeah.
Are those changes reversible?
No. Because what ends up happening is once the crown ether actually complexes the ion, you, in order to get it to reverse, you have to either put it in a different solution where that the binding constant is so high that it doesn't want to give it up. So we are actually designing new materials that you can actually reversibly turn it on and off by using a carboxylic acid arm that actually helps in the charge conservation. So basically, in order to give it a counter ion of sorts.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.